Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. Today we're joined by David Morgan from Duke University to talk about the relatively new field of material religion. David Morgan is Professor of Religion, with a secondary appointment in the Department of Art, Art History and Visual Studies at Duke. His most recent book is The Embodied Eye, Religious Visual Culture and the Social Life of Feeling. And other recent works include The Lure of Images, A History of Religion and Visual Media in America. And he has edited the volumes Religion and Media Culture, The Matter of Belief, and Key Words in Religion, Media and Culture. He's also the co-founder and co-editor of the international scholarly journal Material Religion and co-editor of a book series at Routledge entitled Religion, Media and Culture. So I think you should all agree that he's in a very good position to speak to us about this. So first off, Professor Morgan, can I call you David?
Sure,
welcome.
It's good to be here.
For the benefit of me and for all our listeners, what is this field of material religion? Could you give us a sort of brief overview and introduction?
Sure. It's part of a much broader move to broaden and shift the emphasis on what counts as religion, to focus on everyday life, to focus on the popular media, the things that people practice their religion with, their clothing, spaces, pictures. It's really whatever allows religion to happen as a material, visual, sensory phenomenon rather than principally understood as a discourse about ideas and moral principles and practices. Not to eliminate those, not to marginalize those, but to widen, as I said, the understanding of what religion is as a human behavior.
Yeah, because I think in my situation, I'm still just starting PhD work. It seems to me that this whole appreciation of the things that are part of religion, the places where it happens, from my perspective, that's quite normal. I mean, that's what you should do if you're doing research, but I'm presuming that wasn't always the case.
No, it wasn't always the case, primarily because the study of religion was deeply, importantly shaped by the heritage of Christian theology in the Western world, Europe and America and elsewhere. Also, it was deeply shaped by philosophy. As people grappled in the 19th century, in the colonial age, thinking about the plurality of religions, the tendency was to think about them as systems of belief, as intellectual constructions, worldviews, this kind of thing. It's also the rise of belief as a propositional statement has been very important to the modern nation state, where the separation of church and state into separate sovereign realms has been enabled by understanding religious commitment as a question of private or personal beliefs.
Yes.
And it's part of the modern construction of the citizen subject, this interior private domain of consciousness that has its own right to believe whatever it wants. And that's how the modern state has, in a sense, regarded religion as safe. It's ensconced in the privacy of the individual. It's when it starts leaking out and this dangerous fluid traverses those private spaces that religion becomes a problem. That's how often many modern governments regard religion as a problem.
Mm.
Unless, of course, it's the privileged religion or the civil religion of a nation, where then it operates under certain acceptable limits.
Which always dictates what governments would label as religion, and they tend to use their definition of religion as being as the normal religion.
That's right.
Which in many cases is what is Christian-like.
Yeah, it's the dominant shared religion of the particular nation.
Mm. So all of these kind of material embodied aspects of religion, did you have to did you and others in the field of material religion, have you had to develop any new methodologies, terminologies, things for coping with it that just weren't there in the academic study?
Well, yeah, I think there was a in the 90s, 1980s and 90s, there was a what's called an ethnographic turn. Certainly ethnography was far older, been practiced for over a century by anthropologists, ethnographers, ethnologists, but that became an important resource for rethinking the study of religion in Europe and America, because it meant getting out of the library, out of the archive, out of the university lecture room, mm-hmm. and into the lived worlds, you know, that people occupy. That's been an important component of this. I think also, generally speaking, the study of ritual, which has evolved into the study of performance and performative behavior, has recentered the study of religion into everyday life. And it doesn't always have to be everyday life that scholars study as the performance of religion. Sometimes it's the very exalted, sublime, very rare moments that happen, you know, in religious ceremonies. But in any case, it's the recognition that people create the worlds they live in by performing them. That words and ideas and the articulation of abstractions, these are important, but they're important as part of a larger network of interacting agencies. Mm-hmm. Theology is no longer regarded by scholars of religion as the queen of the sciences, occupying this privileged space from which it can nominate and dictate what religion is and what good religion is, what bad religion is, what's proper, what's improper. That paradigm is gone, far gone, though some theologians wish it might return, but it's not going to, I suspect. And so there's a real interest among scholars of religion, and I might say increasingly among some theologians, which I think is a very good thing. They're interested in religion from the ground up, not just from the top down. Part of that emphasis on the study of practice and the performance or enactment of religion includes then the focus on spaces, the focus on things, focus on the sensations generally, hearing, seeing, touching, smelling. And what's most important, I think, is their integration, their deft integration into what counts as experience.
Hmm. So it might help our listeners if you could take us through a sort of actual study of material religion. I mentioned before, like, you, if you want to talk us through, sort of give us an overview of your most recent book, mm-hmm. If you'd like to do that, or sure. if you can think of another example that you'd rather use. Mm-hmm.
Well, I could make a couple of references. You mentioned my latest book, The Embodied Eye. Here my task was to respond to an important critique of visual culture studies and, by extension, material culture studies in recent years, and that it particularly that the study of images and images generally in visual culture is excessively visual, that scholars or historians in particular tended to isolate vision from the other senses. And this, I think, is a problem. It's a legitimate critique, and I began, and I'm hardly the only one who's been thinking about this for the past many years. In my study of the way people live, I've always been interested in asking, how does religion happen visually? Because the point is not to think of the image as some sort of encoded message that delivers content and then vanishes, which is, you might say, what an illustration does. But to think of the image as a social operator, as part of an arena of social action. So the shift has been from the image to to visual practices, to the operation of the image, from the image to what it does, from what the image means to what the image performs. Mm. That's a major shift, I think, that characterizes not only what I understand to be visual culture studies, but it also is at work in the broader practice of material culture studies. Older generations of material culture studies focused on the object. They developed marvelous skills for interrogating the object and paying, you know, singular attention to its physical features and its production. And that's very useful knowledge, and it's indispensable knowledge. But it's only part of the story. I think what is no less interesting is the social trajectory, the career of the object over time, its circulation among various kinds of users and people, different contexts. That, I think, is what more recently many different authors have taken up. They've done a kind of ethnography of the social biography of the object and following it, and understanding that as objects enter new social circumstances, they transform. The object itself may not change very much, but its perception, its social presence, its uses, how people respond to it, that changes dramatically because it enters new taxonomies of naming and use that give it new purposes. So anthropology, visual culture studies, even I think some of the best art history is now focusing on this aspect, this practice-centered aspect. That's been very popular. And the other thing, and this is what I'm trying to do in my book, is to understand that vision is not isolated. If you take this social career of the object, you realize that it's constantly interacting with all kinds of things. The image is, the object is, and that it's not isolated. It exists in a matrix of interacting forces. And that when human beings experience something, they don't just see it. They don't just hear it. They taste it. They feel it. They share it with other people. They trade it. They touch it. They put it on shelves and worship it. They have all kinds of ways of interacting. And there's no reason for us as scholars to isolate those from one another. We might do it in the case of an individual study just to you know, focus in particular on a certain aspect. But ultimately, the task of the scholar is to reintegrate, at least the religion scholar, I would argue, to reintegrate the culture as this dense mesh of interacting forces. So theoretically, in addition to techniques like ethnography, material analysis, people have become very interested in actor network theory and related ideas to understand, in effect, the larger connections, the connectivities of artifacts in the worlds that they help create.
Can we talk about a specific object?
Sure.
Can you take us through?
Well, the one I've worked on a good deal over time are images of Jesus. I've been very interested in images of Jesus, mass-produced images. My work really began in that quarter, and the book I'm going to be working on next, Visual Worlds, is an attempt to look at the history of visuality in modern Christianity from the Reformation to the present. And one of the pieces in that I'm very intrigued at is the likeness of Jesus. Why does he look the way he does? Obviously, he looks many different ways depending on the social setting you're in, but there is a kind of prevailing likeness of him. And I'm very interested not just in the image, but in the image as object, you know, where it hangs, what its context are, how it's used in the instruction of children, for instance, how it's used in spreading the faith, how it's used in forming devotional attachments and commitments, how it's gifted, because modern commodified culture, there's virtually nothing that can't be sold, and we acquire much of the world around us through economic exchange. So we can't denigrate exchange, which is which had, I think, by an older generation or generations of scholars, had been something you differentiate from religion. I think what, you know, given the reality of consumption in our lives, that that practice is no longer prevailing. We really need to understand religion as an economic reality. And in the very practical sense, one of the most common economic characteristics of religion is gift exchange,
right,
which is a kind of economy. Marcel Mauss taught us that, you know, many, many years ago. But it's a lesson we need to keep learning as we try to understand religion not as a single object, not as a single book, not as a single idea, but as a social reality.
Hmm.
I find my way back to Durkheim regularly and consider him one of my most important teachers. And I think focusing on economic relations, not just, I mean, in sort of a capitalist sense, but I mean the exchange of gifts or the exchange of favors that structure the relationship between people and materialize that relationship, in effect, and therefore materialize the sacred as part of this relationship, is very interesting. And images as gifted objects play a fundamental role in that. So people, if you interview them, they can tell you who gave them their picture of Jesus, on what occasion, to whom they in turn gave the image, where they display it, what it means in terms of its spatial presence.
Hmm.
You know, I'm not as interested, or just not only interested in the theologies that they can provide. Those are sometimes very insightful. But I'm really interested in the presence of the object.
Mm.
You know, how does it change the way they live their lives? That's what I want to try to understand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert in this by any means, but I've heard a lot about, you know, if you're interviewing someone, or it's the impact of if you go into their home, or particularly people's bedrooms and things,
right,
like the things that they choose to, you know, have on the walls and around in there,
yeah,
you know. To really tell you a lot about.
Well, the homes are are spaces, structures that are the essential scaffolding of human life.
Mm.
This is why homelessness is such a horrible tragedy, because if you don't have those walls in our world telling you who you are, where you're safe, who has access to you, and what are the sort of inner spaces of your life and the more public spaces, all of these things are what craft an individual, a human person, as our time and place understands that. And the role that religious materiality plays in that, creating and maintaining those worlds, is fundamental if we want to understand what religion does in everyday life.
Mm. Moving on a little bit to, is there any influence particularly of the cultural context of interactions with material objects, like in the West, to say the West in quotation marks, you know, do we have a different way of engaging with objects than in other parts of the world, or are there any differences?
Yeah, well, certainly there are,
well,
any number of differences. I think in the modern era, capitalism is now a virtually completely global phenomenon, and it takes a cultural logic with it that is pervasive. So we think about the instrumentality of objects. We think about, you know, the role of exchange in every dimension of life. It's hard to think about a part of our life that isn't commodified,
yeah,
in some way. Capitalism is one of those, as I say, a kind of cultural logic that is particularly invasive and pervasive. I mean, it's very interesting to look at the role that objects play in creating homes, the role that objects play in differentiating public versus private space. And these concepts are culturally rooted and vary considerably. Some parts of the home are strictly private among some Americans, and elsewhere in the world, you know, space is shared. It's shared with large groups of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So you have very different conceptions of domesticity and private versus public. Objects that have power vary considerably from culture to culture. I'm really fond of complicating people who feel they live in an exclusively secularized space, because everybody's got objects of power, things that protect them, things that have a disproportionate capacity to mean in a physical sense, you know, to broadcast their identity, to safeguard their identity. So, I mean, Protestants are often, I work on them a lot, and they are quite fond, particularly conservative Protestants are quite fond of saying they have no icons, there's no sacred space in their life, there's no sacred object. And they insist on this until you start talking about the Bible, for instance, as an object. And then suddenly they realize often there's something powerful there, something that has to be revered in a special way.
Yeah, be that rooted in a sort of idealized, hypothesized the Bible, or indeed, I can remember plenty of instances of people with their Bible, you know, and that's that particular object.
Yeah, for instance, a very common evangelical practice, one that it annoys evangelical theologians, but if you look at lived evangelical life, this practice is, I've seen it so many occasions, is it's a practice of Christian divination. Suppose you don't know what you're supposed to do in some situation. You're maybe perplexed because you don't know what God wants for your life. I've heard many say this. So what they do after praying and after thinking about it, consulting with fellow believers, they may take the Bible and open it suddenly and point to a text, and then read that text, and that is, they understand it to be, God's message to them. So it's really like tea leaves or a tarot card deck, properly used, that it's a way of discerning the mind of God. Mm. So that's using the Bible not as a, you know, conventional text, but using it as a random generator, so for the purpose of divination.
Mm. So this is all very well in a context of religion and maybe of religious people, but how does this all fit into popular culture? Like, do we see material religion in out there in the more wider popular culture?
Oh, certainly. I mean, Walmart or comparable big chain stores.
Yeah, Tesco, Sainsbury's.
Yeah, exactly. Sell religious puzzles, religious pictures, religious objects. I bought at Walmart one year a Santa Claus on his knees praying before a cross, which is, you know, a delightful attempt to reverse what is by many evangelicals perceived as the loss of religion from the public square, the loss of Christmas as a religious ritual to a commercial culture. So it's an attempt to re-pristinate or re-sacralize commercial time, profane time, popular culture. In America, the discourse on the Christian nation is powerful among evangelicals and some others, people who feel that the religious mission and purpose and origin of the nation has been lost, and it's a project of recovery. So popular commercial products, the use of the internet, the use of popular press, the use of bookstores. When Mel Gibson's famous film came out, there was a kind of mass appropriation among evangelicals of commercial theaters to screen the image, and they would buy up every ticket so that this normally completely secular space was transformed by 250 members of an evangelical audience who then appropriated it for their purposes. So popular culture is sometimes vilified, it's sometimes targeted, it's sometimes seen as the proper arena for religious reappropriation. But clearly, since it's a market culture, since it's a commercial world today, if religion can't thrive in the commercial medium, likelihood is it won't thrive. You know, it has to be able to work through commerce, through mass production, through consumerism generally. Of course, this bothers people, and people worry about losing control of their religion to the forces of the marketplace. But any realist will, I think, quickly, religious or otherwise, will quickly discern that this is such a fundamental condition of modern life that it has to be dealt with in one way or the other.
Yeah, and saw a presentation yesterday. I don't think you were at this particular one, but it was about sort of material aspects of the non-religious and sort of embodied non-religion, and you have a real emphasis upon parody and sort of parodying religious imagery and religious messages and things, and through T-shirts and cards and tattoos and all sorts of things. You know, very interesting parallels. Just two final questions, I think, which are both quite large. We've been talking about material religion here. A lot of these objects are sort of imbued with the sacred in some way. So I just wondered if you could talk about the relationship of the concept of the sacred to material religion and how it plays out in your work.
Yeah. Well, it used to be that the sacred was defined, I mean, this goes back to Durkheim, but to many after him in religious studies. The sacred was defined as the extraordinary, as in contrast to the profane. It couldn't be the same as the profane. It had to be different. Its specialness is what constituted its reality and its presence. Well, they're special and they're special. In some sense, what you could mean by special is what's simply marked off as a place to be, a thing to own, something to touch, something to see, something to be aware of, something to enter into some sensory cognizance of, be touched by. I think what we've learned in the past generation is that privileging a definition of the sacred in terms of the extraordinary, the absolutely unique, the sublime, the numinous, this higher consciousness is work sometimes, but not often. There are a lot of religious behaviors which show that what's special is what's ordinary. It's those religious cultures that make use of the everyday world of rocks and trees and stones, but also the commercial marketplace, that regard the family home, humble as it may be in many instances, as a special place. So special doesn't need to mean gilt with gold and occupying some vaunted altar. It just means it's the place where important things happen. And I think what we've come to realize in a robust way about materiality is that those spaces are constructed in material means, and that matter is not simply sort of the footstool of the God. It is where religion happens. It is the medium of religiosity in many cases, and it's how religion happens in everyday life. Also, you know, on high altars with, you know, Latin and grand vestments and very special, unique moments. Religion is happening all over the planet in many different ways, and material in every instance.
Definitely. I just wonder, I should have mentioned this right at the start, that we're here, the reason we're getting to speak to you is because you're in Edinburgh at the Religion and Society Sacred Practices of Everyday Life conference. And I just wondered, we had this sort of 2-hour roundtable discussion earlier, which is quite interesting. So if you had any reflections on your own work, as a result of this conference, any sort of themes have come out for you?
I think one of the things I've learned here, and it's been very useful being in a British context where there is a different configuration of religious institutions and the state, different than in the U.S. And British academics seem less bothered, less anxious, less nervous about what we call church-state relations. In the United States, religious studies is anxious about Christian theology and its symbolic capital. It still has an enormous symbolic capital because there's so many private universities and colleges that are church-related and have large religion or Bible or theology departments. And there are many important seminaries and divinity schools which are servicing large church bodies in the U.S. And there is this anxiety around the First Amendment to the Constitution about church and state relations. So American religion scholars deal with this tension on an everyday basis in a way that British scholars, at least to my foreign eye, don't as much. And what happens, unfortunately, in the U.S., is there's a kind of vilification either of religious studies among the Christian theology folks or of Christian theology among the religious studies people. Not all the time, but it happens. And it's a constant element, whether it's in the background or foreground in the study of religion in America. And what I was happy to see here modeled for me was that it's possible to operate with less anxiety about that. And the way I would do that is to think about theology as one social discourse among several. And it seems to be that here. Whereas in the U.S., it often still operates with a kind of, and this is me as a religious studies scholar talking, not as a theologian, as a kind of queen of the sciences self-understanding, which simply doesn't work anymore. But in certain seminaries and divinity schools, that the temptation may still be there. I think what I saw here, which was helpful, is there's a way of backing away and seeing the social presence of theology as a professional discourse, as one member in a rather dense network of interacting agencies that create the study of religion. And I'm going to go back to the U.S. and start practicing that ethnography of this discourse to see what if it helps me.
Very nice. And, of course, the materiality of it at the same time. Okay, wonderful. Well, we will have to close off there because we've got a very tight schedule interviews, but it's been lovely to speak to you, Professor David Morgan, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project after our short summer break. You've just been listening to Chris interviewing David Morgan on the subject of material religion. We're just back from the BASR conference in Winchester, and if you're one of the people that Chris or I spoke to there and are listening for the first time, then you're very welcome. And of course, we'd like to thank the committee of the BASR for their ongoing enthusiasm and support for this project. Next week, we continue the theme of material religion or embodied religion with an interview with Marta Trebiatowska on the subject of why are women more religious than men? I'm sure that both of these interviews are going to be hotly debated, so if you have anything to add, please do go to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or our website and get involved. Also coming up this Wednesday, we have a response to the David Morgan interview by our very own Louise Connolly, who you may have heard in our roundtable on building an academic career, which we broadcast recently, which also featured Carol Cusack. If you enjoy the podcasts, please, please do rate us on iTunes. It matters a lot to us. We're always open to comments, criticisms, suggestions, and anything else, either via the website, comments under the posts, or through our Facebook page. And we have a lot of exciting news about the Religious Studies Project to emerge in the next few weeks. But for now, as always, thanks for listening.